Our scripture reading this morning comes from John chapter 6, starting in verse 16. If you'd like to read along with the Bible provided for you, it's on page 1056. The words will be on the screen too. John chapter 6, verse 16. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now, it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there, and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but they had not gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Please be seated.
We come today to the third Sunday of Lent. We're halfway through the season of Lent, and the season of Lent is really a time of intentional preparation to experience the miracle and the mystery of the resurrection of Jesus on Easter Sunday. During this season of Lent, we are walking through the Gospel of John and looking at the 7 signs that John has laid out for us to help prepare us for the 8th and ultimate sign, which is Jesus' resurrection itself. And we're only halfway there. And so if you have not started on this intentional journey with us toward Easter Sunday, I'd like to go back and review a little bit about how we're looking at the Gospel of John. And maybe, just maybe even this morning, if this is your first Sunday attending during the season of Lent, you might say, "Hey, I'd be willing to go on that journey." And we will go on, I'll do the illustration for how John is helping us understand who Jesus is and what he's doing by way of a shameless plug for William & Mary basketball, okay? I've got my green tie on this morning. Go Tribe. They're playing at 2:30 today. NBC Sports Network. I need everyone to watch, and if they win, we all got to go to Baltimore tomorrow for the championship game. William & Mary, we're one of only 5 original Division I schools that has never made the NCAA tournament. I feel it in my bones. This is our year, all right? And if that wasn't enough, there are so many Tribe basketball players that come here. We had the testimony from Omar the other week on our screens. This is a picture of Tom Schalk. Tom Schalk just received the Dean Ehlers Award. It's the most prestigious award in our conference for leadership on the court, off the court, and part of the reason he got that award. See those guys behind him? That is a small group that Tom Schalk mentors and disciples here at the chapel. So, everyone with me, 1, 2, 3, go Tribe, 1, 2, 3, go Tribe. All right, yes. All right, we're gonna do it this year. So having said that, I'm pretty into Tribe basketball. And so I've always been into Tribe sports, but as a father of 4 girls, I was hoping against all hope that someday my girls might be into Tribe basketball. And I hit the jackpot this year because they got to know 2 of the coach's daughters. And they love them. They're right around the same age. And they go to the games, not for the basketball, but to talk to the coach's daughters. And they have just a great time. They have a great time. So I'm watching the basketball. They're talking to the coach's daughters. But we're all bonding together. It's just a great experience. So we've been going to all the games this year. And so one of the games, my mom, their grandmother, she wants to be in on what the girls, the latest thing that the girls are into. So she says she wants to come to a game. So my mom is coming to the game. We're already in the arena, and my mom calls me, and she says, "Hey, where are you seated? Where are you seated? I would like to sit right next to the girls." I said, "We're right behind the Tribe bench." And I go on watching the game, and about 5 minutes later, I get another call from my mom, and she says, Is the tribe the team wearing blue? And my mom is many things. She's a wonderful woman. She's sacrificial. She loved my sister and me growing up so much. She gave herself for us. But one thing she is not, she is not an athletically aware individual, okay? So she says, is the tribe wearing blue? And I said, Mom, I said, I spent 4 years of my life here on top of 4 years of my sister's life that was spent here. 8 years, 8 years of time, your children, 8 years of your children's lives at William and Mary, multiple graduation ceremonies, multiple parents' weekends. Is the tribe, the team wearing blue? Now, what my mom missed was a few signs that may have helped her. You see, the seats in the arena down low, they're actually green, okay? And then the stanchions on which the hoops are set, they're actually green. And there's big letters with the words tribe all over the place. And they always write the word tribe in the color green. You guessed it. Oh, man, there are cheerleaders. The only cheerleaders in the building are wearing uniforms that are green, and there's a big stuffed, it's kind of a weird mascot, I'm not sure how we got stuck with this, Griffin, and his pants are the color green. There were signs all around the arena, pointing exactly to where my mom wanted to be, which was right with her grandchildren. The signs were pointing her right there, but she missed all the signs. The same is true so often with Jesus in our spiritual lives. There are signs everywhere in our lives pointing to the fact that only in Him is there life. But we try other things and they don't work and we get frustrated that they're not working. We go, well, let me just try something else, when everything in our life is pointing us to Jesus, pointing us back to Him. And John's gospel witnesses to this. He says there is only life and life abundantly found in Jesus. And in fact, because there's only life and life abundantly found in Jesus, I'm going to write down, John says at the end of his gospel in John 20, verses 30 and 31, he says, I'm going to write down some signs that you can't miss. You will not be able to miss these signs. They will point you to the fact that there is true life in Jesus. Follow these signs and you'll get to that destination. Not sitting next to your grandkids at a basketball game, but life now in this life and life everlasting. We will walk through these signs together. We've already completed three of them, and today we'll look at the fourth sign. N.T. Wright is a well-known biblical scholar, and he says this about John's gospel. John's gospel is planned as a kind of treasure hunt, with careful and sometimes cryptic clues laid for us to follow. The word he uses for clue is sign. He sets up a series of signposts to take us through his story. And so as we come to the fourth sign this week, I'd like to ask four questions from the fourth sign. These are the four questions from the fourth sign. What does this sign reveal? What does this sign represent? What does this sign require? And how will I respond? As we look at this first question, what does this sign reveal? There are two things that we need to remember that Doug touched on in his sermon last week. You see, the third sign, which is Jesus feeding the 5,000, and the fourth sign, which is Jesus walking on water, they're intimately connected. Usually there's a lot of space between signs, and oftentimes there's a sermon afterwards. But the third sign, feeding the 5,000, then the walking on water, they're right next to each other. And then a sermon explaining them both comes right afterwards and shows you how they both work together. And we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. And so in order to understand what the fourth sign reveals, we need to look at how the third sign begins and how the third sign ends. And Doug touched on both of these things in his sermon last week. How does the third sign begin? It's in chapter 6, verse 4. We read these words. John wants us to be clear that before Jesus feeds the 5,000, that we know the Jewish Passover feast was near. That as we read about Jesus giving bread to this multitude, we need to have Passover on our brain, Passover on our mind, thinking about the story in Exodus. The second thing we need to know is how the third sign ends, and that's in verses 14 and 15. The crowd mistakes Jesus for someone known as the prophet, who Moses predicted would come in Deuteronomy chapter 18. The crowd says, oh, this is the prophet. They miss that he's actually the Messiah. They think he's this other prophet. And then it says that they went to make him king by force. You see, they misunderstood his identity, and then they went to make him king by force. So the third sign begins with a reminder we need to be thinking about Passover, thinking about the book of Exodus, and it ends with the crowd misunderstanding Jesus' identity. In the next sign, this fourth sign, Jesus walking on water, what we see is Jesus using language that directly connects to the Passover story. Jesus using language that directly connects to the book of Exodus in order to clarify his true identity. Remember the crowd at the end of the third sign, they misunderstand who he is. Now Jesus uses Exodus language in order to clarify his true identity. Let's look at Jesus walking on water. I'll tell you a little bit about the story. At the end, when the crowd mistakes his identity, Jesus flees to the mountains. He leaves. His disciples are just left there alone. And so they start waiting for him down by their boat. It's their transportation. It's kind of like you're waiting for somebody and you go, well, I'm just going to go stand by the car because if they're ready to leave, they got to get in the car with me. They're going to come down to the car. So the disciples are standing by the boat. Jesus didn't tell them where he was going, how long he was going to be gone. So they just stand by the boat. And finally they go, look, maybe he left. Maybe he's not coming back. And so they get in the boat and they head off to Capernaum. And you go, why would they go to Capernaum? Well, in the Gospel of Mark, we learn that Jesus made his home in Capernaum. So just imagine no texting, no email, no postal service, and Jesus runs off into the mountains. You go, well, if we're ever going to see this guy again, we better just go back and touch home base, and we'll just wait for him there, and maybe he'll show up. So they get in the boat, they go to Capernaum, they're on their way to Capernaum to try to touch base at Jesus' home. Maybe he went back to his home. We don't know. And as they're going across the Sea of Galilee, this storm comes up. And you go, well, it's just a small sea, a little lake. How bad could the storm be? The Sea of Galilee is 600 feet below sea level. And so the wind from the Mediterranean Sea, a much larger body of water, would come sweeping off the Mediterranean Sea. It would dive down into this valley where the Sea of Galilee was. There'd be a major temperature change because of the elevation difference. And that just stirred up. The Sea of Galilee is just famous for these intense storms in such a small body of water. And so there's this intense storm, and they're rowing, and they're rowing, and they're rowing, and they're not sure if they're even going to make it. And all of a sudden, you pick up the story in verse 19. It says, when they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water. They were terrified, but he said to them, it is I. Don't be afraid. Now, in order to really understand what's happening here, we need a little explanation about what this phrase, it is I, means. It's difficult to translate because if you translate it literally, it doesn't make sense in the English language. There's not appropriate syntax in the sentence. Literally, what Jesus says is, it says, Jesus approached the boat, but he said to them, I am, don't be afraid. Not a proper grammatical sentence. Yet, it gives us the message of what this sign reveals. And although it might be an improper English sentence, it is the proper theological understanding of who Jesus is. The literal translation here is, I am. And so just put a little note there for yourself. It is I equals I am. The New Living Translation gets at this, and they help it make sense in English. But you see what they had to do? They have to take the do not be afraid and make it first. So it says, but he called to them, don't be afraid. I am here. But they have to rearrange the whole sentence because nobody really knows what to do when it doesn't make sense in English, but it makes perfect sense theologically. Some Bibles have a footnote. I took a picture of a footnote. If you have the New Revised Standard Version, this is the footnote on this verse. It says Greek. The Greek, that's what the GK stands for, is simply I am. Jesus walks up to the boat and says, I am. Don't be afraid. Now, Jesus has many options regarding how he might identify himself to his disciples. Hey, guys, it's me. Hey, I think you're stuck out in the middle of this lake. What's going on? Need some help? Hey, what's happening? He could have chosen a lot of different greetings for his disciples, but he chooses this one specifically, I am. Why? Why would he choose the phrase, I am? Remember, the third sign begins near the Passover. The third sign ends with a misunderstanding of Jesus' identity. During the first century, Jews would prepare for the Passover feast by reading the Exodus story. They would read the first 15 chapters of the book of Exodus in order to prepare their hearts for the Passover. And this is what we find in Exodus chapter 3, verse 10. This is the start of the Passover narrative. God shows up to Moses in a burning bush, and he tells him that he's concerned about the Israelites suffering at the hand of Pharaoh, his heart is just broken at the slavery that he sees, to see his people enslaved. And the Passover narrative begins in Exodus 3:10 with these words. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Exodus 3, side note, is one of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible, and so I have to be careful not to preach on Exodus 3, but just to help you understand, it's a series of protests that Moses makes to God. God says, I'm concerned about this. I want to rescue my people, and I'm going to use you to do it. Passover starts right now, Moses. Go, you go. And here's the first protest. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. So Moses' first protest is, who am I, God? I'm a nobody. I've been shepherding sheep for the past 40 years. I don't have the skills to do this. Who am I, God? And God says, look, here's who you are. You're one that I am with. I will be with you. Now move forward. Moses says, okay, if that's who I am, if I am one that God is with, my second question is, who are you, God? Who are you? What is your identity? Could you reveal something to me about yourself? And so you pick it up in verse 13. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And this is the first time God has revealed his name to anyone. He has revealed something about his character to Moses that nobody else got to hear up until this time. Who are you, God? Moses says, if I'm going to go and do this, I need to be crystal clear about your identity. And God says, I'll tell you who I am. I am. As in, I always have been. I always will be. The verb that you use so often to be, I just embody it. I just am. I just is. I just are. I just am. I am the I am. Beginning, middle, end, Alpha, Omega. That's who I am. God makes it very clear what his identity is. His identity is the eternal I am. No beginning. No end. So let's go back to our story in the Gospel of John. Why does Jesus identify himself as I am? He is making it clear that he is God. He is not merely a good man. He is not merely a moral teacher. He is not merely an example of ethical living. And so many people try to reduce Jesus to one of these three things. Oh, I think Jesus is great. Jesus is great. He's such a good guy. Isn't it just neat how he cares for people? I think Jesus is great. He's taught morality and he's really helped our culture understand the difference between right and wrong. And I think Jesus is great because he didn't just teach morality, he lived it out. When he died on a cross, that was a moral example for us all of how we should sacrifice for one another. And although Jesus is a good man, a moral teacher, and an example of ethical living, he is so much more. He is the I Am. He is the Creator who has come to dwell with his creation face to face. In the same way that the Creator knows his creation, now his creation, men, women, little girls, and little boys, they get to know their Creator. We can actually know what God is like. All we have to do is look at Jesus. And John, from the very beginning of his gospel, is desperate for us to realize Jesus' identity is far deeper than what we see on the surface. What does this sign reveal? This sign reveals that Jesus is God. And this is actually the hinge that brings so much together in John's gospel. And again, we'll talk about that a little bit later on toward the end of the sermon. And because John wants us to know that Jesus is God, this is not the only time Jesus makes this connection for us in John's gospel. Many of us are familiar with what are called the I Am statements of the Gospel of John. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the gate. I'm the true vine. Many of us are familiar with those I Am statements, but we're less familiar with what are known as the absolute I Am statements of the Gospel of John. Those other ones, I am the bread of life. I'm the true vine. Those are called the metaphorical I Am statements. They're helping us understand who Jesus is by comparing him to an object that we understand in our world. But along with those, there are several what are called absolute I Am statements of the Gospel of John. I'll give you a quick list here and read one to you. 6:20, which is what we just read here in Jesus walking on water. 8:24, 8:28, 8:58. And 18:5. 18:5 is right when Pilate is looking at Jesus and asking about his identity. And Jesus simply says, I am. And you look at 8:58, this makes it very clear. Jesus says, before Abraham was born, I am. Doesn't make any sense in English. I am what? I am God. You can, when you see me, you have seen the Father. And this concept goes all the way back to the beginning of John's gospel, John 1:14, in the beginning was the Word. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And then 1:14, the Word becomes flesh. God put skin on, entered into our world. John says that we might see the glory of the one and only who has come from the Father, full of grace and truth. It's all over John's gospel. And if we miss it, we miss what John is desperate for us to know about Jesus. Because once you understand that Jesus is God, the claims that he makes on your life, they all make sense. If it is the God of the universe, the one who created you and who created me, who created the beauty that we see outside, if that is Jesus, the claims that he makes on our lives all fall into place. And so let's ask a second question. What does this sign represent? If the first sign reveals that Jesus is God, if the fourth sign reveals that Jesus is God, what does the fourth sign represent? Well, look at verses 16 and 17 with me of John chapter 6. It says, when evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. What we need to zoom in on here is this picture that John's giving us is the disciples set off in the dark. He doesn't necessarily have to tell you that, but he tells you so we are absolutely clear that when the disciples go off without Jesus, there is darkness all around them. Darkness is a key image in John's gospel. John's gospel is such a literary masterpiece. He's bringing all kinds of different images and themes together to help us understand who Jesus is. And what darkness does in the Gospel of John is it represents our life apart from Jesus. I'll give you a few references for darkness in the Gospel of John. John 1:5, right in the first chapter. John sets up so much of his gospel in the first chapter. John 3:19, 8:12, 12:35, 12:46, and 13:30 all deal with this idea that darkness in the Gospel of John represents our life apart from Jesus. And you can see it in 12:46 very clearly. Jesus says, "I have come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness." John 13:30, that verse, that's right when Judas flees the upper room, flees Jesus breaking bread, the first institution of communion. Judas flees that meal. And you know what John 13:30 says? It makes sure we know that as Judas leaves to betray Jesus, it says, it was night, darkness. That there is darkness apart from Jesus. So what does this sign represent? This sign represents the difference between our life apart from Jesus and our life with Jesus. Look at verses 18 and 19. You'll see what a life apart from Jesus looks like. A strong wind was blowing as the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. What does life apart from Jesus look like? The disciples are straining. They're straining against this wind that is blowing, against these waves that are banging over the bow of their boat. They're struggling to actually get to their destination. They're struggling to get there. They're probably at this point are wondering if they're even going to get there at all. And so fear sets in. You read that they're actually terrified. There's chaos. There's water swirling all around them. As Bob Seger might put it, they're running against the wind. That's what life apart from Jesus feels like. Struggle, strain, fear, chaos. Just a constant running against the wind. Now let's look at verses 20 and 21, and we're going to see what life with Jesus looks like. Verse 20, "But he said to them, 'It is I am. Don't be afraid.' Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading." What does life with Jesus look like? It looks like peace. The storm dies down. Sustenance through the journey. They actually are sustained to make it through to their destination. What does life with Jesus look like? It looks like God's perfect timing. Notice when they bring Jesus into the boat, what happens? They reach their destination. It's another miracle within the miracle. As soon as Jesus gets in the boat, they get to where they're going. God's perfect timing is what happens when our life is lived with Jesus. There's a danger in all of our lives when we think about life with Jesus or life apart from Jesus. Here's the danger. The danger is when we live our lives apart from Jesus and we face the struggle, the strain, the running against the wind, the danger is we explain it away with what I call if-only statements. I do this all the time in my life. I say, "Oh, if only I had said this, that relationship wouldn't be in shambles. If only I had made this career choice, I would actually have fulfillment at work. If only I had parented with these principles in place, my children wouldn't be rebelling." And so we're living our lives on our own power, with our own choices, and we're experiencing the running against the wind that inevitably is experienced when we live our lives apart from Jesus. But we explain it away with, "If only this, if only that." No. There's only one if only statement we need, and that is, "If only I was doing life with Jesus." That's where the peace is. That's where the sustenance is. That's where God's perfect timing is. Next time you catch yourself trying to rationalize the struggle that you're in living your life apart from Jesus, just say, if only I would give my life back over to Jesus, live it with his power. That is where true life really is. We sang a song earlier. The song was, "It Is Well With My Soul." Ted played it for the offertory as well. And as we consider what life looks like with Jesus and what life looks like apart from Jesus, I would just ask you that question. Is it well with your soul this morning? Is it well with your soul? And I believe that if we grasp what this sign represents, what our lives look like apart from Jesus and what our lives look like with Jesus, if we can grasp that, we can join with Horatio Spofford and say, whatever my lot, whatever I'm going through, whatever if only statements I'm tempted to make, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul, because it is well with our souls if we live our life with Jesus. And so our third question is, what does this sign require? What does this sign require? If this sign reveals that Jesus is God, if this sign represents our lives with Jesus and our lives apart from Jesus, what does this sign require? It's right in verse 21. They were willing to take him into the boat. This sign requires that we bring Jesus into our boat. This is the action that is required when we realize Jesus is God, when we realize the stark contrast between life with Jesus and life apart from Jesus. We're desperate. Get Jesus in here. Let me bring Jesus into the boat with me. But I think there's an even better metaphor in John 6 than bringing Jesus into the boat. The better metaphor is in John 6, verses 53 through 58. Because, as I mentioned earlier, there's a sermon that comes after these two signs. The sermon is called the Bread of Life Discourse. Doug talked on this last week. In fact, Doug, when we were preaching on the feeding the 5,000, he spent almost the whole time last week in the Bread of Life Discourse, because it actually explains and helps us understand and interpret these two signs. It's sort of a sign pointing us to help us get in the right direction that these signs want us to go. And in chapter 6, verses 53 through 58, you get the summary of the entire Bread of Life discourse. This gets at the deeper metaphor of not just bringing Jesus into a boat, but bringing Jesus into the depths of our very being. Let me read these verses to you. Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in him. Just as the living Father sent me and I live because of the Father, so the one who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Your forefathers ate manna and died, but he who feeds, there's that word again, he who feeds on this bread will live forever. You see, the better metaphor is bread. It's not just bring Jesus into your boat. It's feed on him as the bread of life. And I think this is a better metaphor, because when you feed on something, it gets into the very depths of your being. The whole reason I can move my arms is because the bread that I ate yesterday has nourished my body. The whole reason I can move my legs to the left or move my legs to the right, the bread that I ate yesterday has gone all through my system and given strength to my body to move and to flourish. The idea isn't just bring Jesus into your boat, it's bring Jesus into the innermost parts of your being. I was having lunch with a man on Friday, and he was telling me a story about a healing that he experienced. But before he actually requested prayer for this issue that he was having, he was sort of resisting offering this issue in his life back to God. He felt like it was too trivial. He felt like people were suffering at greater levels than he was suffering. And so he just kept it to himself. It was a knee. He had a knee injury. And it was painful when he was traveling. It was difficult to get up and to sit down. And his wife kept saying, our church has a vibrant healing ministry. They're in Williamsburg now. They came from Northern Virginia, a great church called the Falls Church. And they had a great healing prayer ministry. And his wife was a part of that, saying, you need to come and offer this back to God and just see what God does. God does always heal. He always says yes to our healing. Sometimes he says yes now, and sometimes he says yes when we have our resurrected bodies in heaven. But God is saying yes to our healing. We need to offer it back to him. We need to offer our hurts and our sickness back to him. And so he said, okay, I'll submit. Finally, I'll go and I'll have my knee prayed for. And he said, as he closed his eyes, he just saw a blinding light and this warmth on his knee. And he said it was the craziest thing. He said he was doing squats, you know, before the prayer people. He goes, we just experienced a miracle. God healed this. And to think that I almost didn't offer this back to Jesus. I almost didn't allow Jesus into the part of my body that longed for healing, into the part of my faith that could actually trust that miracles could still happen this day. I almost didn't experience the fullness of the life that Jesus had for me because I wasn't willing to offer this back to God. And so I just want to ask a question. To what part of your life does Jesus not yet have access? What's your knee? You've been saying, no, I'm just going to deal with this on my own. I might have brought Jesus into my boat, but Jesus isn't my bread. I'm not allowing him to dive into the depths of my soul. To what part of your life does Jesus not yet have access? What does this sign require? That we bring Jesus into our boat and that we feed on him as the bread of life. Give him access to our whole lives. And so the last question is, how will I respond? How will I respond to this? If this sign reveals that Jesus is God, if this sign represents my life with Jesus and my life apart from Jesus, and if this sign requires that I bring Jesus into my boat and feed on him as my bread, how will I respond? Well, at the end of the Bread of Life discourse, there's a summary in verses 60 and 70. There's actually four possible responses listed there. There's grumbling in verse 61. There's disbelief in verse 64. There's desertion in verse 66. People just walk away. They go, this just got a little weird, Jesus, this whole bread of life thing. I was actually fine with you being a part of my life, but not my whole life. So I'm just going to kind of scoot over here. And then in verse 68 through 69, we actually see the response of faith, belief. And I would just go, the end of these two signs, there is a response. How are you responding to Jesus? And I want to look at Peter's response in verse 68 and 69, because this is important that he is the only one that actually responds with faith. And I'm going to tell you why in just a moment. Look at his response in faith. Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. Why is Peter able to respond in faith? You see, the third and the fourth sign are coupled together for this reason. There's a public miracle where Jesus feeds the 5,000, thousands of people actually present. And when there's that public miracle, people misunderstand his identity. So there's a private miracle with just the 12 disciples in their boat where Jesus tells them about his true identity. You see, the reason that Peter is the one that responds in faith is because he understands Jesus' true identity. He has had that personal and private encounter where he heard Jesus say, I am. And he realized that Jesus was God. And when he realizes that Jesus is God, it becomes obvious what that represents. That there's a stark contrast between life with Jesus and life apart from Jesus. In Peter's words, you have the words of eternal life. When he realizes that the fourth sign reveals that we can embrace its requirements, that we must embrace its requirements about bringing Jesus into our boats, Peter's words are, to whom shall we go? Who else are we going to invite into our boat? And when we understand that what it requires of us, how we will respond in faith, for all of us to respond in faith, we hear Peter's words, we believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. Have you just had a very public encounter with Jesus? Just kind of said, well, isn't that neat that he could do that miracle? Or have you had that private encounter where you have heard him say that he is God, the great I am, and allowed the implications of that statement to wash over you? If you've never had that private encounter, I'm going to invite Alex to come forward now. And Alex is going to play a song that's going to allow us to reflect on Jesus' identity as the bread of life. And I would just ask, if you've never understood him as the great I am, as the bread that we must bring into our inner being, that you might pray to have Jesus open your eyes and that you might respond in faith with Peter. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God.